So, good morning.
How are you?
Okay. I thought this will be an appropriate way to open our session, chanting the Holy Gayatri Mantra, because the topic of our retreat is the Holy Name. And can you turn it down just a little, the volume, please? Just a little too loud for my... I like to speak a little louder, but then it's too loud. Let's see. That's a little better, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, good. The ultimate holy name is Om. The first holy name is Om. So I thought we could just talk a little bit at the beginning about Om. And we can go back to the Upanishads and the wonderful story of Nachiketa, who went to Yama's house in the Kathopanishad. I hope most of you probably know the story. And he goes to Yama's house and gets from Yama three boons, because he had to wait 3 days and nights without any food or water. So Yama grants him three boons. And the third of those boons is he seeks to know the mystery of death. What happens after death? Does a woman continue, or does it all come to an end with death? And so Yama begins to... First, Yama doesn't want to give him the teachings. He gives him a test to see how I can give you so many good things. But Nachiketa says, no, I don't want any of those things. I want to know the secret of death. I want to know the secret of who I really am. So Yama is pleased and he begins to praise Nachiketa left and right, and is so pleased with him. So finally Nachiketa has to kind of interrupt him and say, all right, now let's get to it. Tell me, what is it? And it's a beautiful mantra. I'll chant the mantra. Anyatra dharmat, anyatra dharmat, anyatra asmat krita kritat, anyatra bhuta cha bhavya cha yattat pasyati tad vada. So that, he asks, Nachiketa asks Yama, all right, that which you see as other than dharma and adharma, as beyond dharma and adharma, that which is beyond a cause and effect, that which is other than bhutat, what has been, and bhavyat, what will be. What you understand about that? Tell me.
Beyond time.
Beyond time. Tell me what it is. Tell me what that is. Tadvada. And Yama gives this beautiful reply. Sarve veda yat padamamanamti tapamsi sarvani chayad vadanti yadichanto brahmacharyam charanti tate padam samgrahena bravimi om iti tat. So he says, the goal which all the Vedas declare, sarve veda, all the Vedas, what they're talking about, what they're leading us to, that to which all tapasya, all the spiritual disciplines which people undertake to try to attain, that goal for which people lead the life of brahmacharya. I'm telling you that in a brief way, in a very brief way, it is Om. It is Om. So here he gets the very in a nutshell. And not only the nutshell, but the nut. This is the seed. This is the seed of everything is Om. The idea is that from Om has sprung all this. And all sounds, all words, all thoughts, all ideas, everything springs from Om. And Om is the Shabda Brahman, is the manifested Brahman as manifested in this universe is Om. Through we go to from Om, we travel back to that primal seed, and then from Om we go to Brahman. He says about that I think I put it here, no? Where did I put it here? That this is the second mantra. Etadhye vaksharam brahma, etadhye vaksharam param, etadhye vaksharam jnatva yo yadichati tasyatat. This syllable, this aksharam, this om, is Brahman. This is param, it is the highest, it is the supreme syllable. And whosoever knows it attains all that he or she desires. Now that doesn't mean, we should qualify, it doesn't mean that if we know Om, if we become self-realized, if we know Brahman, that whatever we want, I want a new car, so I'm going to get that. And I want to get straight A's on all my exams. So if I know Brahman, then I'm going to do that automatically, just like that. It means that, actually what it means is that all desires are fulfilled, because there's nothing left to desire when we know Om, when we know Brahman. All desires are stilled in the state of Purana Kamaha. It's a wonderful idea. We'll come to that again in our Shikshashtakam. It's Purana Kamaha. All desires are stilled when we know that infinite reality. Nothing outside of that. So what is there to be added to that? So we're complete. So there's nothing left to desire, really. So in that sense, we attain all that we desire. So I thought we could read a little bit from Swami Vivekananda to get a sense of how Sportavada, the philosophy of sound as Brahman, and how actually it is from sound that this whole universe becomes manifested. It's a wonderful philosophy, which is not dealt by, Shankaracharya ignores it, he does away with it. But Swamiji seems to have revived it because he discusses it in several places, Swami Vivekananda. And the idea is, as I understand it, which is my limited understanding, that when this universe of names and forms manifests, it first manifests as Om, as that unstruck sound, the anahata dhvani, the shabda brahman. And that can be heard by the yogis, by the saints, those who are completely desireless. They can hear the sound. Then it begins to manifest further as the different sounds of different words, different ideas. And from the names, further develop the forms. So it actually goes from Brahman to Shabda Brahman, to names, to forms. So actually the physical comes after the sound. And let's see if I can find that reading that I wanted to share with you. Sorry, there's too many papers. But Swami Vivekananda is talking with his disciple, Sharad Chandra Chakraborty. And we're glad that Sharad Chandra, he was a very ardent disciple of Swami Vivekananda and a pundit himself, a Sanskrit pundit, but a little bit orthodox. He was a Brahmin and he held to the sort of orthodox beliefs, and Swamiji was always smashing him and poking fun at him. But he used to question Swamiji. If he didn't understand what Swamiji said, he'd say, "I don't understand that." And he'd argue with him. He'd say, "Well, what about this? The scriptures say such and such? Are you contradicting scriptures?" So we should be very grateful to him for being like that. If we had been in Swamiji's presence, we would have said, "Yes, Swamiji, yes, Swamiji, yes, Swamiji." And we wouldn't have learned so much. But he questioned him and he remembered what was said. So I'll read a little, and we won't understand it, because he also didn't understand it, we won't understand it. But he's talking about the Shabda, and he says, all the created objects began to take concrete shape out of the shabdas or ideas in the Veda. For in shabda or idea, all gross objects have their subtle forms. Creation has proceeded in the same way in all previous cycles, all kalpas. The Creator projected the sun, the moon, the earth, the atmosphere, the heaven, and the upper spheres in the same manner and process as in previous cycles. This is the Sandhya Mantra. Surya Chandrama Sodhata Yatha Purvam Akalpayat Prithivin Divam Chandariksamatho Swaha. So then he says, do you understand? And then he says, but sir, how in the absence of an actual concrete object can the shabda or idea be applied? And for what? And how can the names be given to all? And he says, yes, says Swamiji, that is what on first thought seems to be the difficulty. But just think of this. Supposing this jug, he has a jug. Supposing this jug breaks into pieces, does the idea of a jug become null and void? No. The jug is the gross effect. The idea, jug, is the subtle state, or the shabda state of the jug. In the same way, the shabda state of every object is its subtle state. So the subtle essence of every object is shabda. And the things we see, hear, touch, or perceive in any manner are the gross manifestations of entities in the subtle or shabda state. Just as we may speak of the effect and its cause. So the effect is the physical object, the cause is this subtle shabda. And even when the whole creation is annihilated, the shabda as the consciousness of the universe, or the subtle reality of all concrete things, exists in Brahman as the cause. So the cause of creation, according to this view, this philosophical approach, is shabda, is the shabda Brahman. At the point of creative manifestation, when this world is manifested, see, Swamiji doesn't say created. The idea of Vedanta is that the universe is not exactly created as in the idea that God created the world. It's manifested. It's manifested. This sum total of causal entities vibrates into activity. And as being the sonant material substance of it all, the eternal primal sound of Om continues to come out of itself. And then from the causal totality comes out first the subtle image or shabda form of each particular thing, and then its gross manifestation. Now that causal shabda or word consciousness is Brahman, that causal shabda, that Om from which everything manifests, is Brahman and is Veda. This is the purport of Sayana. They're discussing Sayanacharya. Do you now understand? And we can answer along with the disciple. No, sir, I don't clearly understand it. Swamiji continues, well, you understand, I suppose, that even if all the jugs in the universe were to be destroyed, the idea, the shabda of jug would still exist. So if the universe be destroyed, if all the things making up the universe be smashed into atoms, why should not the ideas or shabdas representing all of them in consciousness be still existing? And why cannot a second creation be supposed to come out of them in time? And then the disciple gives a reasonable objection. He says, but sir, if one cries out, jug, jug, does that doesn't cause a jug to be produced. If I say jug, 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 I don't get a jug in my hand.
No.
So the Swamiji replies, no, nothing is produced if you or I cry out like that. But a jug must be revealed if the idea of it rises in Brahman, which is perfect in its creative determinations. So then he describes the and this is a beautiful section where he describes first creation from Brahman to manifest through ideas to manifestation, and then in reverse, when going into samadhi, how everything involves back into Brahman. And then from this we can understand Swamiji speaking from his personal experience. It's not something he's teaching from the books, as we're doing. He's teaching from his own personal experience. He says, at the point of creation, Brahman becomes manifest as Shabda, and then assumes the form of Nada, or Om. At the next stage, the particular Shabdas, or ideas, that variously existed in former cycles, such as Bhu, Bhuva, Swa, Cow, Man, etc., begin to come out of the Om. As soon as these ideas appear in Brahman, endowed with perfect will, the corresponding concrete things also appear. And gradually, the diversified universe becomes manifest. Do you now understand how Shabda is the source of creation? The disciple answers, yes, I just form some idea of it, but there is no clear comprehension in my mind. Then Swamiji says, well, that clear comprehension is not a small thing, my son. When the mind proceeds towards self-absorption in Brahman, it passes through all these stages one by one to reach the absolute, the nirvikalpa state at last. Now he's describing that. In the process of entering into samadhi, first the universe appears as one mass of ideas. First, the physical universe ceases to be present to the mind, and one perceives a mass of ideas. Then the whole thing loses itself in a profound Om. Then even that melts away, even that seems to be between being and non-being. That is the experience of the eternal Nada, between being and non-being. And then the mind becomes lost in the reality of Brahman, and then it is done. All is peace. So why I wanted to bring this up, because we get a sense of how the sanctity of sound, the sanctity of the holy name, whether it be Om or any of the other names of God, how they're directly connected to the divine. How Om is the Brahman in sound form, and how through sound, through the sound of the mantra, whether it be Om or our own personal mantra, that sound takes us back to reality, capital R. The disciple sat mute, hearing all this. The disciple sat mute, thinking that none could express and explain it in the way Swamiji was doing, unless the whole thing were a matter of one's own experience. Yes, he understands. Swamiji has experienced this himself. Then he explains in the reverse way. He says, great men, like avatars, or like Swami Vivekananda himself, in coming back from samadhi to the realm of I and mine, the realm in which we live, first experience the unmanifest nada, which by degrees grows distinct and appears as Om. And then from Omkara, the subtle form of the universe as a mass of ideas becomes experienced. And at last, the material universe comes into perception. Then he says, which Sri Ramakrishna also used to say, ordinary sadhakas somehow reach beyond nada through immense practice. And when once they attain to the direct realization of Brahman, they cannot come again back to the lower plane. They melt away in Brahman. Kshire niravat, like water in milk. So he explains how after experiencing that samadhi, the mind being completely merged and only Brahman remains, then if a great soul like Swami Vivekananda or an avatar comes back to the perception of this world, it goes through this same manifestation. First, the unmanifest nada, and then only Om comes. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, when I come down from samadhi, I have to come down 100 steps for me to be able to say Om. I have to come down 100 steps. After Om, this mass of ideas, subtle ideas is experienced, and then only the physical universe. So how this Om is the sacred syllable of Brahman, and how it takes us to spiritual realization. I think we can get some idea of it here. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, you know, Sandhya merges in Gayatri, Gayatri merges in Om, and Om merges in the uncaused cause, no? The Akhanda Brahma. Sandhya, of course, the prayers of that the Brahmins are taught in childhood to pray three times a day. And it's quite an elaborate prayer, so many different mantras. And as part of that is Gayatri. But as one's spiritual life deepens, all those prayers are not necessary. And just what's the very kernel of the Sandhya is the Gayatri mantra, which we chanted this morning, which is a very powerful prayer for spiritual illumination. Then the Gayatri itself merges in Om. As we deepen our meditation and prayer, the whole Gayatri mantra is not necessary. It merges in Om, and then from Om. And there's a beautiful mantra in the Mundaka Upanishad, which I also put at the end of this our little booklet. Pranavodhano sharohiyatma brahma talakshyamuchyate apramatena vidhavyam sharavat tanmayo bhavet. So pranavaha, Om is the bow. He's giving this image of archery. And some of you surely have done archery. You have a bow, and you pull back on the bow, the string gets very tight, and then you let go of the string, and the arrow flies to the target and hits the target and becomes one with it. So this image is being given. And what is the bow? The bow is Om. The bow is Om. And the Atman, here meant as the Jivatman, our individual self, is the arrow. And we place the arrow on the bow. And what is the target? Brahman is the target. And how do we, with an undistracted mind, the target is to be struck, and the Atman becomes one with Brahman. The arrow becomes one with the target. So Om is the bow which sends the individual me into the universal me. So that's a beautiful, powerful mantra for contemplation. And I hope this gives us a little more insight into the sanctity of the holy name, and why it is so powerful. Because it's also said that the more we can have faith in the practice of the holy name, the more effective it is. So considering these things, we can have great faith in the power of the holy name. Such a power. Sri Ramakrishna used to like to tell the story of a man who was in Lanka, and he wanted to go back to India. How is he going to go? Well, Bibhishana said, no worries, you can just walk on the water. I'm tying something in your cloth. And he tied something in the man's cloth and said, all right, now you can walk on the water. And the man found amazing. He's walking on the... But Bibhishana told him, whatever you do, don't look at it. Don't look at what I've tied there. You just go and have faith and go. So the man is walking on the water, walk across the ocean. And how wonderful, and with great faith he's walking and thinking, how wonderful. What is this wonderful thing with which Bibhishana tied in my cloth? Let me just see what it is. So he takes it and he unties it and he finds a leaf with the name of Rama written on it. A leaf with the name of Rama. And he said, oh, just this. Just the name of Rama. And immediately he sank. So Sri Ramakrishna is giving the idea that we can have faith in the holy name. So let's turn, if we want to actually complete our Shikshashtakam, we should have to do a little more of the Shikshashtakam. We got through the first line of yesterday, we came through the first line of the first verse of Shikshashtakam. All right, let's chant it together. Do we need to practice again? I'll chant one line and you chant the line after me. Cheto darpana marjanam bhava mahada vagni nirvapanam. Cheto darpana marjanam bhava mahada vagni nirvapanam. Shreya kairava chandrika vitaranam vidyavadhu jivanam. Shreya Kairava Chandrika Vitaranam Vidyavadhu Jeevanam Anandam Budhivardhanam Pratipadam Purnamrita Swadhanam Anandam Budhivardhanam Pratipadam Purnamrita Swadhanam Sarvatmasnapanam param vijayati Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. Sarvatmasnapanam param vijayati Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. So yesterday we talked about this first image Sri Chaitanya gives us of the heart as a mirror. And the heart, when it's a perfectly pure and polished mirror, it reflects the divine perfectly. We find the divine is here, right in the heart. But it's a dusty mirror, it's a dirty mirror, so we don't see the image clearly. And chanting the name, chanting the holy name, is the way to polish that mirror. Then he likens this world to a forest fire, a huge and massive conflagration. Davagni is a forest fire. So Mahadavagni Nirvapanam, the holy name extinguishes that fire. That fire we discussed yesterday, ultimately we find, what is the fire?
Desire.
The fire of desire. And that is extinguished by the holy name, because the holy name is one with the divine. And when we taste the divine, we become Purnakamaha, all our desires become stilled. Then he gives this third image, which is a wonderful image. There's a certain kind of a lotus called Kairava, which a white lotus which blooms, not in the daytime like most lotuses, it blooms at night in the moonlight. This is a lotus which blooms in the moonlight only. So here he's describing this lotus which is of the very nature of Shreya, all blessedness, this lotus of Shreya is blooming in the moonlight. What is that moonlight?
Knowledge.
We can say that. I like to think of it as the name itself. The name itself is that moonlight. It's not harsh like the sunlight. It's gentle like the moonlight. And how beautifully Swami Prabhupada has translated it. O name, stream down in moonlight on the lotus heart, opening its cup to knowledge of thyself. So the lotus, of course, is a almost ubiquitous symbol in Hindu iconography. We find it in so many different ways, the lotus feet, the lotus eyes, but perhaps the most important and appropriate symbol for our spiritual life is the heart as a lotus. And what I love about this symbol is when we picture a lotus as a bud, it looks rather unremarkable. And not ugly, it's an elegant form, but it's a closed bud. There's nothing too much interesting about it. When it opens, what a glorious beauty. And what a very subtle and refined fragrance comes out of that lotus. And all that beauty of the lotus is there in the bud. It's already there. Similarly, within our heart is the divine. It's already there. But as long as the lotus is closed, as long as the heart is still closed, as long as the dust is still on the mirror, we don't see it. But it's there. And when the heart opens, we experience the glory of the divine. Already it's there. It's there within us, hidden. And the idea of the heart opening, we also feel that in spiritual life. In one sense, that's the whole job. That's the whole job, is to open our heart, to expand our heart. Our hearts are narrow. We're thinking only of ourselves and our immediate loved ones and our loved things. When the heart opens, it becomes filled with love for God and filled with love for all beings. So in a sense, that's the job of spiritual life, to open our heart. Now, when we talk about heart, we're not talking about the muscle that's pumping blood, though the connection is clear. The heart, without the physical heart, the body, the physical heart is the most important organ in the body. It is what, from out of the heart comes the life force. The blood is pumped throughout the whole body, so the heart forms the very core of the physical body. Similarly, we're talking really about what is called the spiritual heart, which is at the core of our being. And it is said and is felt by the seekers to be in the center of the body, as it were. If we have to locate it in the body, it will be located approximately in the area of the physical heart, but rather deeper than that, somehow located here. And we can't be shown. If you cut open the body, you won't find it. We have to find it ourselves. It's in the subtle body. And as we continue our spiritual disciplines, we begin to understand that it is here. And we follow the emotional heart to the spiritual heart. The emotional heart, where we feel love, where we feel sadness, we feel it here. No? Where do we feel sad? Where do we feel happy? We feel it here. We touch that emotional heart and we go deeper. And there we find the spiritual heart. So this idea of the name streaming down in moonlight on the lotus heart, opening it. And I love to take that image when repeating the name, to feel that, as it were, the name is falling down on the heart. The name then is no longer being repeated by the lips. The name is falling down in moonlight on the lotus heart. Now, another important idea here is that this lotus blooms at night. It doesn't bloom in the day. It blooms at night. Why is that important? At night, everything is still. Everything is quiet. The mind is quiet. It's like a night of the senses. No, this is in Christian mysticism. St. John of the Cross gives this idea of the night of sense. When we discipline the senses, the senses are always going out, as the Katha Upanishad says, paranchikani, the all going outwards. We have to turn the within. So that the outside night and the inside, and as Sri Krishna says in the Gita, the yogis, what is night to the yogis, the day is the daytime for everybody else, and what is day where we live and move in the, what is our day, what is day to us is night to the yogis. They, because for them the life of the senses is dark, they don't find any light there, because they find the light in the spirit only. But we who don't see the light of the spirit, we find only this light. So this is our day, and the life of the spiritual life is like a night. But we have to enter that night, the night of the yogis, and then that night of the yogis will become our day. When that lotus opens in the moonlight that shines in that night. So as we repeat the name with the lips, gradually the name becomes repeated in the throat. And we have to go deeper than that. The name has to be repeated not by the lips, by the throat, but by the heart. And then we can feel that the name is repeating, is flowing down in moonlight on the lotus heart, and the lotus heart opens into the glory, revealing there then we get as the, in the translation, opening its cup to knowledge of thyself. We get the knowledge of the direct, means the direct experience of God through the chanting of the holy name. And this second part of this second line, I have never been able to fully understand. It says vidyavadhu jivanam. Maybe you can help me, because It's the image of knowledge as the bride. Vadhu is the bride. Vidya, Vadhu, Jivanam, the very life of the bride who is knowledge. So I think what I'm, the sense I get is that the holy name is the very life of the, who is the life of the bride? The life of the bride is the groom. And in the Vaishnava tradition at least, the groom is Sri Krishna. And we are all the brides of Sri Krishna. In the sense, the Christian nuns also have this idea that they all become brides of Christ. But generally the monks don't follow that. It's just the nuns who follow that. They become, and they even wear a wedding ring. They become married to Christ. Yes. So in certain denominations of Christian nuns, Christian monasticism, for women, they call themselves the brides of Christ. So here, the see, Krishna is the groom, but knowledge itself, the very life of knowledge, is the name. So I think, tell me if you understand something more from it. I always, because it's an unfamiliar idea to me, this idea of the bride and the groom, It's clearly something hinting at something profound, that the very life of the bride of knowledge is the name, is chanting the name. And chanting the name brings knowledge. What kind of knowledge? Knowledge of God. That's actually the only, we know that there are different kinds of knowledge, and what we ordinarily call knowledge, in Mundaka Upanishad, he asks about knowledge. The seeker asks the guru about knowledge, and the guru says, well, all the things that are we consider knowledge, including the Vedas, including all the study of the Vedas, all the different departments of study and knowledge, these are all aparavidya. They're all still the lower knowledge. Even the scriptures are lower knowledge. That paravidya, that is beyond. This vidya that's being discussed here, that's paravidya. The name takes us to paravidya. Let's move to the third line. Anandam buddhi varudhanam. Here he gives us yet another image. This first verse is full of wonderful images, wonderful symbols of spiritual life. Remember, we have the mirror. Then we have the forest fire being extinguished. Then we have the lotus. Then we have the bride of knowledge. Now we have an ocean of bliss. An ocean of bliss which is expanding. It's expanding. And we're going to drown in that ocean of bliss. As in the poetic way of the translation, this translation is wonderful. As I mentioned, it's not a literal word-by-word translation, but it catches the essence of the teaching here. O self, drown deep in the waves of his bliss. It reminds me of the story of Sri Ramakrishna asked Narendra. He said, talking about drowning in the ocean of bliss, and he said, suppose there is a bowl of nectar, and you are a fly. And what will you, where will you sit to drink the nectar? And Narendra says, well, I will sit on the edge and I'll crane out my neck to drink the nectar. And why on the edge? Why not go in? No, then I may be drowned. Oh, but my child, this is not the ordinary ocean. This is the ocean of Amrita. Amrita, of course, means both. We can say nectar, ambrosia, and Amrita. Immortality. Not the non-death. The word ambrosia apparently comes from the same root, Amrita. Amrita, ambrosia, the same root it comes. That ambrosia in the Greek mythology is that nectar by which the gods become immortal. If you get a drink of ambrosia, and that's what they live on. They live on ambrosia, and if any mortal gets a sip of ambrosia, he or she too becomes immortal. So it's the same meaning. It comes from the same root. So anandam buddhi varudhanam. This idea of how to conceive of the infinite, how to conceive of the divine reality. Our minds are limited. We always put limits on things. But the most infinite things that we know of in this world are the sky and the ocean. So that's why oftentimes the divine is likened to the sky or to an ocean. An ocean extends seemingly without limit. And this is not an ordinary ocean, but an ocean of bliss. This image comes again and again in the songs also. There's that wonderful song. Let's see if I can remember the line. That Kamalakanta is singing about the black bee of my mind. It's drawn in sheer delight to the blue lotus flower of Mother Shyama's feet. Majlo amar mun bhramara, Shyama pada neel kamale. In the blue lotus flower of Mother Shyama's feet, the black bee of the mind is likened to a bee which is drawn irresistibly to that lotus flower. And it becomes one. The bee is black and the feet are black. And black becomes one with black. Who is left to describe this? It's a mystery. And then he says, Kamala Kantir, how is it? Purna, purna.
Kamala Kantir Muni, Asha Purna
Atodine. Asha Purna Atodine. His desires are, he's completely fulfilled in the end. And Ananda Shagar Utale. He swims on the sea of bliss. Yeah. Swims on the sea of bliss. That experience is, that's really what this wonderful thing about spiritual life. If we are not getting some joy in spiritual life, then we should look at how we're practicing. Because if spiritual life is dry and painful and we really don't want too much to do with it, then we need to look at how we're practicing. Because spiritual life is a life of joy. It's the life when we begin to chant the holy name. We will begin to taste the joy, but we have to practice. It won't come after one or two days. But Swami Brahmananda used to guarantee it. His disciples would go and would complain to him, "We're not getting anywhere." After a week or two or a month or two, he said, "I won't say anything to them then." And he said, he knows, if they keep practicing, they'll come back to me. And he would say, if you practice hard for 2 years, if you don't experience anything, you can come back and slap my face. That kind of guarantee he gave. You can slap my face. Think of it, Rajamara and Swami Brahmananda, the spiritual son of Sri Ramakrishna. He would tell his disciples, you come and slap my face if you don't get some results. No one would slap his face. They would get the results. All right. Anandam Bhutivaradhanam. Pratipadam, pratipadam, at every step, this idea of chanting the name continually, as we begin to develop the habit of taking the name of God, it starts to take on a life of its own, and we can chant it at every step, at every step. In fact, we were talking this morning, that's one of my favorite things to do, is to take a walk, especially a walk in nature, in the forest or in the mountains, and do japa. Not talk. Ordinarily what we do when we take a walk with our friends and we yak all the time and yak, 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 and we talk all about our lives, and we're not even noticing the beautiful scenery or anything because we're talking all the time. Rather, we walk in silence. We can walk, even with our friends, even with other people, though we feel uncomfortable at first. I'm with my friend, but I'm not talking. It's almost like there's a kind of intimacy that we're afraid of when we're together with someone in silence. But we can walk in silence and take the name. And when we attach the name to our steps, it's like a rhythmic, it becomes a beautiful rhythm at each step taking the name. I talked a little bit about how when we start our practice of mantra, we do it out loud. And that's good. And even in together, we sing the holy name together. That's very good. But we also need to go deeper. We need to do it in a subtle way. And so we start chanting it mentally without, perhaps at first the lips will move a little bit, like that as we're chanting. But even that, gradually as we go deeper, even that should stop. Now we find that though we're not moving our lips, but still there's an impulse to move the lips. The muscles of the throat feel a little bit of pushings as we're doing the japa. So still, there's the connection between the thought and speech has not yet been broken, because we have this urge, as it were, the lips have an urge to move as we are repeating the mantra. Then, when it descends deep into the heart, that connection can be broken. That's not an easy thing to do, but it can be broken. Our Swami Atmarupananda told us about someone, a devotee, who used to recite the Gita every day. And he could recite the whole Gita in about 15 minutes, mentally. How is it possible, we ask? Impossible. It's possible when the connection between the thought and the speech is broken. It's not possible to recite it so quickly if we are having to recite it with the lips. Even if the lips are not moving, but mentally still it's connected with the lips. But when that connection is broken, then, yes, the Gita can be recited so quickly. Pratipadam Puranamrita Svadanam. Here we have again this idea of Purana, this Puranamrita, tasting that Puranamrita. It becomes like nectar. The name becomes like nectar. Tasting his nectar at every step. At every step. Sarvatmasna paramparam. It's the name is like a bath. It goes back to our first idea. So we have these images now: the mirror, the forest fire, the lotus, the bride, the ocean of bliss, every step of our life, and then a bath for all souls. All souls can bathe in that supreme bath. We feel at the end of the day, we've had a rough day, and sometimes what we need more than anything is to jump into the shower and just wash off the day. But that washes off only the physical day. Still, the mind may be all tied up. The holy name is a way to bathe the mind of that, wash off the difficulties of the day. At the end of the day, at the beginning of the day, we take a shower, we take a bath before we start our day. In the same way, we give a bath to the mind. It's like we wouldn't think of going to work, I presume, without having a bath, right? Indian tradition is like that. Americans I've learned that many people, they take a bath at night and not in the morning. But somehow Indian tradition, until you had your bath, the day hasn't really started. Hmm? You can't really start the day until you have your bath. Though sometimes we delay it a little bit, especially on the weekends. But at least before lunch, we should have our bath, right? Then the day properly starts after we have our bath. But why are we just having a physical bath and ignoring our mental bath? We shouldn't do that. We take our mental bath also. What is the mental bath? The name, the holy name. We take a bath in the holy name. And it's a wonderful image also that it's not just something we're repeating with the lips. It's something that we can feel that we're bathing in the name. The name is flowing. It's expanding beyond our limited being. So that it's like water flowing. Just as it's like moonlight falling on the heart, it's also like water in which we bathe. That way, we can make our japa more interesting when we expand the ways in which we conceive of it. It's not just, perhaps we also just concentrate on the sound of it, but then we can also feel that it's like moonlight. We can feel that we're bathing in the name. We can feel that the name itself is an ocean of bliss in which we're sinking. When we take these different images, it helps for our japa. Otherwise, the tendency is As we get familiar with our mantra, as we learn to repeat it, the mind becomes very devious. The mind learns how to repeat the mantra, and at the same time, think of other things. I'm doing my mantra, I'm repeating the mantra, but I'm also just planning out my day, and I'm going to, what I'm going to say to my boss today, how I'm going to ask my boss for a raise today. I'm planning those things out. And so we're not, yes, we're chanting, they call it, it's called mechanical japa. It's not entirely bad, it's good. It's better than nothing. But how wonderful it is if we can immerse ourselves fully in the name, take that bath. So we can take these different images to help us, of the moonlight, of a bath, of a gentle rain extinguishing the fire burning in our heart. All these different images as we connect them, because it's something that the mind is not completely familiar to, and so we can take the help of these different images to enrich our japa. Then Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam, all glory, all victory to the glory of the divine name, to chanting the divine name of Sri Krishna, or any name, of course. So that brings us to the close of the first verse of Shikshashtakam. Should we have a little discussion? I've talked for now at least 45 minutes. There's only so much we can absorb in any particular talk, and only so much this mouth can speak in a particular talk. Any questions, comments?
You said about the thing that as we keep chanting, even we can come to a state where the connection between the mind and the mouth, even it will, without talking, it can directly go to the heart.
Yes.
So is that the way even the mantra gets connected to our heartbeat, Maharaj?
Or I'm not sure that it needs to be connected to the physical heartbeat. Though in the Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition, they do emphasize that. There's a wonderful tradition of mantra practice called the Prayer of the Heart. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole book about it.
The Way of the Pilgrim.
Yeah.
And the Pilgrim Continues His Way. It's two books in one. Have you read that book?
Yes,
you have, yes. It's a wonderful, we get some insight into that practice, because there, he also discusses that very thing, how at first, the pilgrim, of course, he's wondering, he's heard that it says in the Bible, you should pray without ceasing. How to do that? How is it possible to pray without ceasing? So he goes around asking people, and no one can tell him. Finally, someone gives him a little bit of a hint, and then guides him that you need a staritz. It means you need a guru. You need a teacher to explain this to you. So he goes around looking for a staritz. It means a holy father, a monk in this case, who has been practicing for many, many decades. And he finds his staritz, who guides him in this practice. And he has to go meet with his staritz every day or every few days and report his progress. So he gives him a mala. As we use the mala, often many of us also may use a japa mala, a string of beads. He also is given a mala, and he starts repeating the holy name, which is in the form of a prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. And he goes on repeating, and at first he's repeating with the lips, and just to repeat 1,000 in a day is a big deal. And his lips get tired, and his hand gets tired, and it's a big struggle, but gradually he gets to where he starts to take joy in it. And we'd have to refer to the book. Perhaps we can refer to it later. Gradually, he is taught that repetition needs to go from the lips to the heart, and that it gets connected to the heartbeat. And with every heartbeat, the prayer is repeated. And so it becomes his experience over time. That remind me, am I remembering correctly? I think I'm remembering it correctly.
Yes.
That,
yes.
See, we're like, we don't even need to talk. All I need to say is, the way of the pilgrim. You can say, oh, yes. then I can say, you know, some other thing. Practice the presence of God. Then I can say, Sri Ramakrishna, japa like a chain in the log. Yes, I know that. Yes, got it. You know, there was prisoners. There was a prison, and a new prisoner just came to the prison, and they're all, of course, their cells are all separate, but they can talk to each other. And so they were talking, and he found an amazing thing. Someone would call out a number, 27, and everybody would laugh. All the prisoners would laugh. Another prisoner would call out, well, 231, and everybody would laugh. And he asked his cellmate, well, what's going on? Oh, well, you know, we tell jokes to pass the time. But we've all told the joke so many times that we know all the jokes. So all we have to do is call out the number of the joke, and people remember that, and we all laugh. So the new prisoner thought, well, that's great. That sounds nice. So he took his turn. He said, 630. But there was dead silence. He got confused. And then he heard someone say, some people just can't tell a joke. So that's like us too. We need to actually talk much. We can just tell one or two words, and everyone understands what we're talking about.
Or someone will be yelling 630.
So.
So Maharaj, is this what even Holy Mother said about Ajapa?
Yeah, Japa Japa. When it begins to repeat itself, we can try for that. Today, we can try for that. Let the mantra repeat itself. We find sometimes if we go to bed, we repeat the mantra and going to bed.
Yeah.
If when we wake up, we also find we're repeating it. How wonderful. Now, can the mind go on repeating the mantra all night long? Yes, it can. That's a wonderful experience. That means we are getting a little deeper in our experience. So I'm also struggling to understand what is ajapa japa, the constant repetition of the mantra. See, we can, if we're doing some physical work, or washing dishes, or we're sweeping the floor, we can understand how we can repeat the name while doing the work. But when we're talking, or when we're thinking, maybe we're doing some intellectual work, it becomes more difficult. It seems like it goes on hold. But in Ajapa Japa, it seems the mantra will continue. At what part of the mind is occupied with the name all the time. And that is why Sri Ramakrishna could say, do your duties with one hand and hold to God with the other hand. Or he would say, just do your duties with one or two annas, just a small part of your mind, and the rest of your mind you keep on God. Yes, Mother?
It's not that Sri Ramakrishna says, be a maid servant in a rich man's house.
Right, yes.
That is ajapa, like you can think of.
That the japa certainly can help us maintain that attitude. That attitude that my home is...
Krishna is everything,
and this house is not really my house. This is Krishna's house. This my family is not really my family. They all belong to God. Yes. Yes.
Maharaj, Thakur also talks about dividing the mind that watches the other mind. Is that relevant in this context, Maharaj? From mind doing its own japa and the other mind concentrating on the other chores.
On the other chores. Yes, I when I think of that, I think of when we are doing our japa and watching to see that the mind doesn't run off to other things, no? Because that's a challenge in meditation. It's a challenge in the japa, which is also a form of meditation. Repeat, focusing on the nada yoga, the yoga of sound. when we meditate on the mantra, and then the mind starts running off. So that's right, there's a part of the mind that needs to actually watch and see that the mind is not running off. You know, some people will say, what? Repeating the same word over and over again? How boring. What a waste of time. You could be I would want to spend my time thinking good things and just repeating one thing all the time. Actually, we think, you know, we have this idea that we have many noble thoughts and we think good things and all that, and that we think our thoughts. But actually, if we reflect a little, I think all of us here know, it's more a question of our thoughts thinking us. It's not that we think thoughts, but our thoughts think us. It means we are just swept away in the current of thought, which is by and large unconscious. Our stream of thought is by and large unconscious, following along the little grooves in our mind, following along our samskaras, and again we're thinking the same thoughts, which we have some worry, again and again that same thought, what am I going to do about my colleague who I'm not getting along with, or what am I going to do about my son who's not getting good grades at school, or what am I going to do about my mother-in-law with whom I had an argument last week, or what am I going to do, the same old ruts. Rather take the name. Take the name. And taste that amrita. Gradually, those who practice it find that if the mind is released from running in all those ruts, actually it will have much more power for creative work and positive thought. So actually, repeating the name is not something that brings us dullness or boredom, or that it takes our mind away from constructive thinking. Rather, it frees our mind so that when we want to apply it to constructive thinking, it's much more free. It's not caught in so many things. What shall we do now? Shall we have a song? Did you bring song books or what?
Yes, ma'am.
So what song shall we sing that everyone knows, a song that we all know?
The song is you told. Everybody does
know. Is it in the book?
Yes.
Maharaj, I have a word to say.
Yes.
Coming to the word Om, right?
Yes.
It is universal.
Yes.
Over the years, NASA tried to grasp the sound of the universe.
Okay.
They did not succeed.
Okay.
Recently, they claimed that the sound waves, the vibration, they gave a name, like it starts with Om.
Is it?
Yeah. This is a recent work, since 4 or 5 years
okay.
It's going on. And my theory, I think, that's why human being or cows, the first word comes, the sound wave comes from their throat is like Om,
uh-huh.
Amma, Amba, everything, mommy, mom, the sound waves, I think that's my theory, but
sure.
I don't know how far I'm true.
Sure, why not?
But I'm going to see what it is, but the NASA, they said the wave of the sound waves of the universe, it's like Om, so the universe or everything is surrounded by the wave, like Om.
Oh.
Scientifically it is proven.
Mm. Swami Vivekananda would be pleased. Yes.
How these people, centuries, they say Om, right?
Yeah.
How they perceive the vibration, I couldn't comprehend.
Well, because it's perceived on the subtle level.
Now the NASA, they claim.
They claim, huh? Well, good for them. I bet there's some Indian scientists there at NASA too. So they can understand it. Good. Swami Vivekananda, of course, describes Om and how it's the most universal sound because it comprises all the basic sounds that can be formed by the vocal organ, beginning with A, which is the very first sound created at the very back of the throat. And as the sound moves forward through the mouth, it becomes U. And then as the mouth comes to a point, it's a M. So A plus U plus M, and if you apply the sandhi, it becomes Om. So Om comprises actually all possible sounds
and
that can
be
made.
The first sound of the after the mother's womb, any even human beings, even cows, they say Amba, Amba. And any language they start, Mommy, Mom,
yeah.
Amma,
yeah.
Ma, and everything is related to that thing, I think.